Astanele nejonie, nejonie, astanele.
Vilina Kako, greetings everyone. This is Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond, and I'm your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. This show focuses on the political struggles and resistance of Indigenous peoples. Today's episode comes in two parts. First, I interview Sarah Deer, who will tell us about the Native American aspects of the Violence Against Women Act, legislation recently passed by the U.S. Senate and currently before the House. Second, I'll be speaking with Andy Major and Wendy Gagne from the Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign, a partnership between the Onondaga Nation and neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, also known as Noon. The Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign is a major statewide educational project in New York to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first treaty between the Haudenosaunee and the European settlers. I'll tell you more about these topics and my guests, but first I want to let people know that the program is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, a place also known as Mattabesset, homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. If you want to catch up on past episodes or share information about the show, go to my website for the audio archive, where you can listen at your convenience. That's at www.indigenouspolitics.com. I also administer a Facebook group by the same name as the program, Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond, where you can follow global Indigenous news items and get bulletins about upcoming episodes. And listeners can also write to me with feedback on the program. My email is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. I also want to put out the call for free syndication. If you have an independent radio station near you that might like to broadcast the program free of charge, drop me a line. Again, the email is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. Now back to the focus of today's episode. First, turning to the pending Violence Against Women Act, also referred to as VAWA. On February 12, 2013, the U.S. Senate passed its bill authorizing $659 million over 5 years for various programs targeting domestic violence. The Senate bill includes new protections for LGBT and Native American victims of domestic violence and gives more attention to sexual assault prevention. One of the biggest obstacles to getting VAWA through Congress is a provision that grants new authority to tribal government to prosecute domestic abusers. Currently, tribal courts have no authority over non-Native Americans who domestically abuse Native American women on tribal lands. The Senate VAWA bill includes a provision that would grant tribal courts the authority to prosecute in those cases, but many House Republicans opposed the provision and argued that tribal courts would not uphold the constitutional rights of non-Native Americans charged with sexual violence. Speaking to this issue on the show is my guest, Professor Sarah Deer. She is a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma, and her scholarship focuses on the intersection of tribal law and victims' rights. She is an associate professor at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. She has taught at UCLA Law School, the University of Minnesota School of Law, and Lewis and Clark Law School. She joins us by telephone from Minneapolis. Greetings, Sarah Deer. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thanks so much for joining me on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's wonderful to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
I'm just reviewing my audio archive and noticed that it was May 2007 when you were last on Indigenous Politics, and that was when you were speaking about the newly released report from Amnesty International USA titled Maze of Injustice that relates to this issue that I want to talk to you about today.
Yes.
And listeners, that's Maze of Injustice, the failure to protect Indigenous women from sexual violence in the USA. I want to ask you, Sarah Deer, if you could start by letting our listeners know a bit about your background, personal and professional, and also how you came to do this work and how far, maybe if you could speak at some point about the trajectory from that Amnesty International report to the recent Senate bill passage of the Violence Against Women Act.
Sure. Well, I'm a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma, and I actually was raised in Wichita, Kansas. So I was I was raised as an urban Indian, and my identity really stemmed from the community there in Wichita, Kansas. I began working as a rape crisis counselor back in 1993. I was 20 years old, and I did direct advocacy for Native women in Lawrence, Kansas, where I was a student. And most of the women that I worked with had some connection to Haskell Indian Nations University. So they were Native students or Native faculty. And some of them had been assaulted on campus, but many had been assaulted on their homelands and had come to Haskell to get an education. And the stress and the, you know, uncertainty of being in a new place sometimes led them to call the rape crisis line.
Mm-hmm.
So that really informed what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be part of helping Native women sort of recover from sexual assault and build a life for themselves. So I was led to go to law school. I thought at the time that I would prosecute sex crimes, and that was sort of my goal when I entered law school. But I went in a little different direction and started thinking more about policy and how federal law really impedes the ability of Native women to find justice. So I ended up going into more of a policy direction with my work, and I'm a law professor now, but that's a relatively new development in my life. And when I began teaching, what was important to me is that I would be able to continue to research, write, and advocate for Native women. And fortunately, I'm in a place where I can do that.
Right. Excellent. And also want to acknowledge that you've just recently been named chair of a U.S. Department of Justice Federal Advisory Committee designed to develop protocol for responding to sexual assault in tribal communities. Could you speak to your new role and how you are working with the Obama administration on these issues?
Sure. Well, I was asked by Eric Holder to chair this committee, and we are tasked with trying to untangle the web of jurisdiction for Native women living in Indian country. And what that means is we have, unlike any other place in the United States, Native women have to navigate a system that involves at least three separate federal agencies in order to find justice for rape. So we have the Department of Health and Human Services, which houses the Indian Health Service. We have the Department of the Interior, which houses tribal police as well as some tribal prosecutors. And then we have the Department of Justice with the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's offices. And when those three agencies don't work together, what happens is that Native women who report a sexual assault are left basically to build bring the pieces of their lives back together on their own. So the task force that I'm chairing is designed to try to ensure a constant stream of communication among and between those federal agencies so that they're being consistent. One of the things that I've heard and that advocates have told me is those three federal agencies sometimes issue even conflicting policies.
Mm-hmm.
So the task force is designed to try to sort that out and make sure that all the federal agencies are working from one set of protocols. And it's going to be an interesting couple of years as we try to do that.
Now, I'll get back to that because I want to get into some of those contradictions and issues around jurisdiction and coordination and the interface with the federal government. But jumping just for a quick summary of what happened with the Senate passage of the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, as the acronym is being referred to, on February 12th. This was a 78-22 vote in the Senate?
Yes.
And could you give our listeners a sense of the history of the law? It's my understanding that it first passed in 1994, and that last year, 2012, was the first time it was not authorized.
So the Violence Against Women Act, as you said, or VAWA, was passed originally in 1994 as a strong bipartisan piece of legislation. In fact, it was called the Biden-Hatch bill, if you can believe that. and Hatch has since abandoned the Violence Against Women Act for reasons I'll talk about in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that every 5 years, the act needs to be reauthorized. And that is to keep the budget available, the line item to actually appropriate money for this bill. And so the five-year reauthorization has been a constant. And we have now a situation where the law has expired. It expired back in 2011. And so if the VAWA is not reauthorized, then none of the funding programs are stable. In other words, Congress could decide not to fund all of the programs available under VAWA.
Mm-hmm.
So what has happened is that each time the act is reauthorized, Congress checks in with the experts, the people who are working directly with victims across the United States, and asks basically, what are we still missing? You know, what pieces of this problem are still prevalent because of some sort of legal issue, and can we address that as Congress? And so what they did in 2012 was they identified three key categories of women in the United States who still can't find justice on a regular basis. And those include LGBT women and trans men, mm-hmm. and immigrant women who do not have a documented status in the United States, and Native American women because of the jurisdictional tangles at the tribal level. So when the Senate drafted the 2012 reauthorization, they included special provisions that would address these gaps. And because these three categories of women are politically problematic for Republicans,
mm-hmm.
they actually put a stop to the bill. It did pass the Senate in April of 2012 with a vote of 68 in favor, but the House never brought the issue to a vote. So the reason was largely based in these concerns about special provisions for these women that, you know, again, the Republican Party is not known to embrace these three categories of women. So they refused to put it to a vote at the end of the year.
I see. Right. Now, the new Senate bill that just passed on February 12th, 2013, as I understand it, does provide services or has provisions for services for women without regard to sexual orientation or immigrant status, right?
Exactly.
So that made it in this time. And then this question around jurisdiction and authority for crimes committed against American Indian women on reservations. So
yes, all three of those categories are included in the current 2013 Senate bill that was that passed on February the 12th.
So then the question will be, what happens when it gets to the Republican-led House?
Correct.
Will they block it again?
Right.
I see. Now, we know that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans as a grouping and American Indian women are not mutually exclusive categories. But I want to zone in and ask you to speak to this question of jurisdiction and authority for crimes committed on reservations around issues of governance and sovereignty. Some of our listeners, they know about reservations, but maybe people don't realize that reservations are part of Indian country, which really is a different legal terrain. The way that I think about this legislation is it really, you know, crosses the intersection between civil rights, that is like appeals to equal protection under the law, and sovereignty rights, the right to tribal authority to pursue these cases. Could you unpack some of this?
Sure, I'll try. So the problem right now for tribal governments, and it's important to note that tribal governments pre-exist the United States Constitution by, you know, 10 or 11,000 years, depending on your perspective. But the problem
yes.
has been in the last century, both the Supreme Court and the federal government have started to provide or started to impose restrictions on the kinds of things that tribal governments can do. And one of the things they've done, there's law review articles full of the various sort of restrictions that Congress has imposed on tribes. But the one that's most relevant for the Violence Against Women Act discussion actually comes from the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court in 1978 issued a ruling that basically said tribes cannot prosecute non-Indians. And so prior to that time, tribal governments had been exercising criminal jurisdiction over anyone who came into their community and committed a crime. There were other kinds of restrictions placed on the tribe, but by and large, tribes had the authority and exercised the authority against anyone, regardless of who they were, what color their skin was, what race they were. Supreme Court put a stop to that, and until Congress issues a correction to that decision, tribes are left to basically their hands are tied if the perpetrator of a crime is non-Indian. There's nothing that the tribe can do. They have to depend on either the federal government or the state government to prosecute that crime. And many times they just don't. So if we're going to restore jurisdiction to the tribal governments, which is what we're trying to do with the Violence Against Women Act, one of the concerns that's been raised is, will defendants in these tribal courts be given the rights that they are allowed in federal and state courts? It's interesting that that's the question being raised by the Republicans, because right now, tribal people are prosecuted by tribal governments, and no one seems to be concerned about their civil rights.
The concern
is when we want to prosecute non-Indians.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the Republicans have become these civil libertarians who are concerned about the abuse of power, which is sort of ironic. But that's really what the objection is. The objection is, can we trust tribal governments to ensure that people are given due process in tribal courts? And that's what we're up against.
Wow. Well, when I was saying it's at the intersection between civil rights and sovereignty rights, I meant the civil rights for Native women.
Oh, yeah. Well, obviously, that's not even part of the discussion for many of the Republicans. Their focus has been solely on the perpetrators.
And now, how does that 1978 ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court interface or draw on the Major Crimes Act?
Well, the Major Crimes Act was the first piece of federal legislation that allowed or sort of imposed federal authority in Indian country. And that's why in many reservations, the crime is actually investigated by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI is really not in the business of looking at violent interpersonal crime. They're trying to take on Enron and terrorists and drug traffickers. So Indian country is the only place where the Federal Bureau of Investigation would be coming in and actually investigating a crime that happened, which would include rape. But that law I outlined some specific types of crimes that the federal government would have authority over. And they're really the felonies. So any violent crime where the punishment would be a year or more incarceration. But what happened when that law was passed is, even though it didn't divest tribal governments of their inherent authority to prosecute crimes, the federal government, for about 100 years, sent a message to tribal governments that we have exclusive authority. We are the only ones that can prosecute murder, rape, kidnapping, sex abuse, and the tribes are divested of the jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
That actually isn't what the legislation says. So in the last 30 years or so, tribes have started to prosecute crimes like homicide and rape. So they share that power, the concurrent authority that the tribe can prosecute a crime and the federal government can prosecute a crime. But after 1978, only the federal government can prosecute a crime committed by a non-Indian.
And now, is it any non-Indian, or could it even be an Indian who's not enrolled on the reservation where the crime is committed?
It's interesting. There was some back and forth between Congress and the court starting in the 1990s. But as of a few years ago, the court clarified that tribes do have criminal jurisdiction over any Indian. They don't have to be from that reservation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear. The circuits are a little split on the question of whether the person has to be enrolled somewhere. Typically, what we tell prosecutors when we train them on this issue is that the person should be recognized as an Indian by their community.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're not enrolled, the federal government may still have the jurisdiction in that case.
I see. So if it really is about any non-Indians or any Indians, this really is a racial distinction then, isn't it? Not just a governmental or an indigenous distinction.
It is, and it's a very frustrating distinction as well. For instance, my spouse is non-Indian. If we were to travel together to the Navajo Reservation, I could commit a crime there and be, you know, penalized by the tribe and prosecuted by the tribe, and my husband, who would commit the same crime would be immune from tribal prosecution. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that neither one of us is Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, we don't have any connection with that tribe, but I could be prosecuted and he couldn't. And that presents some really interesting questions when it comes to whether tribes are a racial classification or a political entity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and it also shows sort of the contradictions inherent in the settler colonial world that we live in, because now you've got indigenous women not only having to appeal to federal protection, right, which often seems to be a contradiction in terms, but also do so on the basis of racial equality, which has often been used in the past to undercut tribal sovereignty.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking to the settler colonial question, I wanted to know if you could speak to the colonial roots of sexual violence committed against indigenous women. And also, I'm just thinking about, you know, the Republican backlash against these categories, against immigrant women, against LGBT subjects, and against American Indian women. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to frame those as though they're all mutually exclusive. But you can see, you know, this question of homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, xenophobia, right, is coming from a nativist, that is a white settler sort of backlash. And yet it's the colonial roots of sexual violence that are operating in the first place.
Absolutely. You know, when you talk to tribal elders, you talk to people that are really well versed in the tribal traditional law, you know, rape was so rare that in some languages there wasn't even a word to describe that kind of crime because they didn't need it. So the tribal governments who have been, you know, sort of dealing with women's equality, with homophobia as being contrary to tribal traditions. So it's interesting that the Republican opposition is to three categories of women that have been impacted the most by colonial rule.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, and also just speaking to the American Indian women in this equation, the fact that these crimes are committed in vast disproportional skew in terms of non-Indian men, right? There seems to be a predatory nature to these crimes. I mean, all I think of rape and all forms of sexual violence is predatory. But, you know, what do we make of the fact that so much of this is being perpetrated by non-Native men against Native women?
I'm really glad you asked that. One of the challenges that we've had in addressing the jurisdictional problem is a seemingly inability to accept the statistical data that's been consistently coming out since the mid-1990s. And that data is telling us that most Native women who are raped by a non-Indian. And that data comes from victimization surveys, unlike, you know, a data collected from reported crimes. So this is really what's going on. And the data has been consistent mm-hmm. for over 15 years. And it's really unusual in American criminology to see interracial sexual assault statistics. And some of that has to do with gentrification and where people live and who they are around. But most crime in America is intraracial.
Mm-hmm.
So a perpetrator is more likely to attack someone of his own race. The only exception to that is Native women. And Native women, almost 80%, anywhere between 60 to 80% of Native women report that their perpetrator was non-Indian.
Mm-hmm.
That's outrageous when you compare it to the interracial statistics for all other groups.
Mm-hmm.
So something is going on. Something is either giving these perpetrators permission to target Native women, or there's something about Native women that attracts perpetrators.
Mm.
And that piece of the puzzle is going to be critical if we are to move this legislation forward in the House.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and also, can I get back to that then? Because as I mentioned earlier, you know, the sort of the complications of even relying on federal law for help, you know, sort of going to the feds that have, you know, been the problem in many ways in the past. I know that you've done a lot of work on restorative justice, and I wanted to ask if you could speak from the Native feminist critiques that you've lodged around the law as remedy, but also that you've also really theorized the limits to restorative justice. And what I'm getting at here is that, you know, many times I'm trying to look outside of the state, outside of the settler colonial state, for the source of the remedy. And there have been critiques from radical women of color, for example, around the Violence Against Women Act, by talking about some of those frameworks and their limitations. I wanted to know if you could speak to some of those feminist critiques, but also what you have found to be sort of some of the limits of restorative justice in relation to the particularity of Native women's issues having to do with these jurisdictional quandaries.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. I mean, the federal criminal justice system is not going to be the savior of Native women. In fact, the federal criminal justice system is largely responsible for the high rates of crime in Indian country. So, when I go to Congress seeking the remedy in the Violence Against Women Act, part of my underlying goal is that we need the federal government out of our business. We need the federal government to not police our communities, because they don't do it well, and they end up, you know, harming and throwing away a great number of our men. So the Violence Against Women Act does, in other contexts, present some real quandaries for radical feminists of color, because it sort of reinforces or celebrates the criminal justice response to crime. So we have to be very cautious of what the Violence Against Women Act does. The piece that I'm most interested in, actually, I think would, in the long term, get the federal government out of the business of prosecuting crime in Indian country and put it back in the hands of tribal officials, of the sovereign governments that exist in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? So let's say the federal government got completely out of the business of policing Indian country tomorrow. That's not going to happen, but let's assume that for a moment. What would tribes be able to do with some of these very violent offenders, men who are serial rapists or molested 100 or so children in some of the boarding schools, BIA employees in some cases in the 1980s? What would the tribe do if there was no other entity taking action?
Mm-hmm.
That's a difficult question, because a lot of our ability to govern ourselves has been damaged over the course of the last couple hundred years. And in addition, a lot of these crimes would not have been committed prior to the colonial intrusion into our lives. So we're left to wonder, how can a tribe respond to something like a violent, I should clarify that all rape is violent. Whether there is physical force or coercion or a drug or alcohol induced sexual assault, mm-hmm. what can the tribe do? If we're really struggling with this question, we don't want to replicate the system that has been imposed on us, because it hasn't worked well.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is, how do we hold people accountable under tribal law or tribal tradition without replicating Western law and order? The thing that concerns me when we talk about responding to sexual assault using traditional tribal law is that there's a tendency to sort of want to implement sort of a mediation answer, something that's more of a, I think Robert Yazzie, who is a Navajo Nation Chief Justice, called it a horizontal justice mm-hmm. instead of vertical justice. The thing that concerns me about that is, are we really prioritizing safety? Because many of the people who commit these kinds of crimes are master manipulators. And whether the system is a Western law and order system or it's a traditional mediation-based horizontal system, they will use that system to torment victims.
Mm.
So as we begin to rebuild a tribal response to sexual assault, we have to be really mindful of that. And safety has to be a priority. If a woman is not safe, either emotionally or physically, it's going to be difficult for her to participate in the system that's going to hold her perpetrator accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, as we start to revisit how tribes will do this and how tribes can do this, and many are,
mm-hmm.
We have to prioritize safety.
I agree. Thank you so much for laying that out. I really appreciate it. Any closing thoughts, as we're just about out of time?
I'm really hopeful. I'm hopeful that the tribal provisions in the Violence Against Women Act will pass the House sometime this spring. And the reason I'm hopeful is because I think that more and more Native women are speaking out, and our stories are being heard, and that's really critical. We have to educate Congress so that they understand the issues. And ultimately, you know, the long-range vision for this whole process is that tribal communities will have full control over how crimes like this are treated in tribal communities. And it's unfortunately has to happen piecemeal, mm-hmm. has to happen sort of one Congress at a time. But I'm committed to it because I believe that tribal governments can respond to these crimes on their own terms. And I think Native women are going to lead that effort. So that keeps me hopeful.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much then. On that note, Sarah Deer, really appreciate you being on the call with us here at Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll be in touch. Mahalo.
And again, listeners, that was Professor Sarah Deer speaking about the Violence Against Women Act and its provisions for tribal court authority. Now let's turn to the second part of the show. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be hearing from two people from the Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign. This is a partnership between the Onondaga Nation and Noon, neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. The project is a major statewide educational campaign in New York to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first treaty between the Haudenosaunee and European settlers. Haudenosaunee is the indigenous term for what is commonly referred to as the Iroquois Confederacy, made up of six nations, originally composed of the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca nations, and later including the Tuscarora Nation. To this day, the Haudenosaunee retain the two-row wampum belt on which the first treaty was originally recorded. The belt illustrates a mutual three-part commitment to friendship, peace between peoples, and parallel living in perpetuity. Speaking to us on the call, we have Andy Major and Wendy Gagne. Andy Major is the project coordinator for the Two-Row Wampum Renewal Campaign. He has been active in movements for peace, social justice, and environmental preservation for over 30 years. Andy is a co-founder of Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation and a longtime staff person at the Syracuse Peace Council. He lives in Syracuse with his partner and their 9-year-old son. Wendy Gagne is a clan mother for the Beaver Clan of the Onondaga Nation. She is actively involved in education and in speaking and writing on behalf of her community. She is a former social studies counselor at the Onondaga Nation School and former editor of the Onondaga Nation News. Wendy lives on the Onondaga Nation, which is also home to several of her adult children. They join us by telephone from the office of the Syracuse Peace Council.
Greetings, Onondaga Clan Mother Wendy Gagne and Andy Major of Neighbors of the Onondaga. Are you both on the call?
Yes, we are.
Yes, greetings, Kahalani. Great to be with you.
Thank you both for joining us here on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's really good to have you on the program to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first treaty between the Haudenosaunee and European settlers and to learn about the Two-Row Wampum Renewal Campaign. I want to start by asking if you could each tell our listeners some about your personal background and political orientation and how you've come to work on this campaign together.
I'll start. Yowehaskanu. My name is Wendy Gagne, and I have grown up on the Onondaga Nation and have found myself to be in the position to speak on behalf of our people on occasions such as this and hope to convey a message from our people that we're still here, we're still surviving, we're carrying on our traditions, the teachings that have been handed down orally from our ancestors, and we are just surviving in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is Andy Major, and I have worked at the Syracuse Peace Council for many years as part of our Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation project, and have worked in general on peace and social justice organizing for several decades, and feel that it's a privilege to be able to partner with Wendy and other people from the Onondaga Nation to try and get our people, the non-Native community, to understand that we owe a debt for due to the treatment of Native peoples, due to the fact that we have not upheld our end of these agreements, starting with the Two-Row and then many agreements after that, and also that there's a great promise of working together collectively to try and protect the Earth on which all of us and our futures depend.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to acknowledge, too, Andy, for our listeners, I want to acknowledge that we had you on the show before, back in 2008, talking about the work of Noon, Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, and explaining to us what the kind of alliance work going on between the tribe and the neighbors of the tribe. This is really important. And I think with the renewal campaign, what I hope to explore with you on the call today is really to look at the way that treaties are alive and that they're in perpetuity, and to try and unpack some of these issues, whereas many people think that treaties are, you know, long gone, done, broken, forget it already. Could we talk through some of that, and also to talk about what you mean by the two-row, and also to explain to our listeners what is wampum? It's been the butt of many jokes that are demeaning to Native peoples, and yet it's such an important aspect of Native life in this region.
Oh, there's a lot there. Wampum is our fire. We use wampum. We still use it today. We use it in our ceremonies, and we carry it with us. And the treaty belts that were made by our ancestors so many years ago are still held in high regard by us. We honor those belts, and we look to the other half of the belt, which is the U.S. government, the American people, citizens, to honor those agreements as well. Goswenta is the name of the Turo, which was made in, I believe it was 1613, and it was the first formal agreement between the settlers who came to the shores, and we made room for them, by the way, and they settled, and our leaders saw that we needed to have some kind of agreement about how we would live side by side, and that's exactly what the Turo or Goswenta is. It's an agreement telling how we would live side by side as neighbors. We would travel in our vessel, in our canoes, down one row, and the newcomers would travel in their ships and their boats in another row, side by side, and not interfere with one another. We would continue with our own ways, our own ceremonies, and they would bring this way of life which they have brought. And our leaders still recognize this. We hold it in regard today. We are respectful of our neighbors, and we expect the same treatment, although history has had some very negative and bad parts of it, and we've come a long way, but we're still here. We're still carrying on those teachings from our ancestors. And part of it is you made a reference to wampum and people making jokes, and we've withstood all that. Our leaders were strong. They've been teaching us for years and years, and we hand it down to our children. We hand our language down to our children. So we're not people of the past, and we don't want to be. We're continuing. We're alive.
Mm-hmm. Thriving, not just surviving.
Oh yeah, definitely, mm-hmm. Definitely. Our way of life revolves around our environment, and we hold our ceremonies according to the changes that come every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a connection that, you know, is real, and it's good.
Andy, would you speak to the issue of the parallel side-by-side part, that non-interference? Because certainly we're all living within a system of colonial domination. And what I see as so beautiful about the campaign is really trying to live outside of the kind of domination that is like unilateral power over tribal nations, and how settlers have been part of that, and how to undo that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you know, as Wendy described, the belt itself has this image of these two purple rows traveling the length of the belt, one representing the Haudenosaunee in their canoes with their laws, their customs, their way of life, and the second representing us newcomers, and that we would live together in peace and friendship and respecting the laws of nature. And so the focus of this campaign is really twofold. One is to say that we have not We have not respected the sovereignty of the Haudenosaunee and other Native peoples. We have not lived up to the commitments made under this agreement. And that in doing so, and very linked to it, we are destroying the natural world on which we depend. So it's an educational and advocacy campaign that seeks to take this message that we find both very wise and very simple and straightforward. So we think it's a great model for people to think about, of all different kinds of people living together in peace and friendship and respect. So we want to, primarily by providing opportunities for Wendy and other Haudenosaunee leaders to talk about the treaty and their culture and the history of relations between our peoples, to educate, you know, many thousands and hopefully millions of people through this coming year about the history, about the treaties, and about our responsibility today. Because just as the Haudenosaunee continue to exist today and live in their communities, as Wendy described, we believe that this Turo should be alive and well today. And very recently, on February 11th, we held a kickoff event for the campaign here in Syracuse. And a very powerful piece of that event was a procession involving pairs of people, one Haudenosaunee or other Native person, with a non-Native ally who have worked together on some project that's been done sort of in the model of the Turo, so that Wendy walked with someone she has worked with for many years on an educational booklet called Neighbor to Neighbor, Nation to Nation. We had people who've worked together in academic settings on environmental campaigns through shared community gardening. So there were 22 pairs of people that really presented this image that, in fact, the Turo is alive and well here in central New York and at the Onondaga Nation, as people are really working to maintain it and keep it well. But that, unfortunately, that's not the case if you go elsewhere in New York State or other parts of the United States. And because it's not well in those other realms, there's great impingement and imposition on the Onondaga in terms of their sovereignty, and we're looking to change that as part of this year-long campaign.
Right. And also, too, there have been so many land cases from up that way. I know that the Onondaga recently had their case heard at the federal appeals, and I wonder if either one or both of you could speak to what is going on with Onondaga Nation, but also how the Turo Wampum Renewal Campaign interfaces with the entire Haudenosaunee. And for listeners, again, Haudenosaunee is the indigenous term for the Iroquois Confederacy, and the Onondaga Nation is one of those six nations.
Well, our land rights action was a long time coming. For years and years, we had heard discussions in our longhouse and in our community. And in 2005, we finally came to one mind and decided to take our chance in the U.S. courts. The reason behind this was all this destruction and devastation that we could see all around us where we live.
Mm-hmm.
We have golf courses, a quarry, an interstate highway. We have all this, some people might call progress, which we see as damaging the waters and the lands where we live. And we have water that flows through our nation that isn't clean anymore, that's been running a chocolate brown for several years, and the pollution into Onondaga Lake, where we can't fish, where our ancestors grew up fishing all along the creek and lake. So we realize that we're a small nation, but we are not separate from the water and the air and the people. So our land rights was based on this environmental restoration. And it is still our hope that we'll win some justice, not just for us human beings, but for all of the life, all the birds and animals that have to live with us. I mean, they're part of who we are, and that was the basis of our land rights. And yes, we've been losing in the court system, but we're going through another appeal, and perhaps we'll be heard again, and maybe really heard this time, but we can only hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, one of the ironic things is that While the case has been before a number of courts at this point, there's never been an opportunity for the Onondaga to really present the evidence, to argue in court about how their land was taken illegally and how, therefore, those takings are null and void. And in fact, the renewal campaign really, in many ways, is an outgrowth of what has happened with the land rights action. That Wendy talked about it being filed in 2005, and at that moment, it felt right. It felt people were very hopeful, and shortly thereafter, the legal situation shifted very significantly and has continued to be quite negative ever since. So in many ways, what we're doing with the renewal campaign is to say, okay, it looks like the federal courts are not going to hear these cases in an open, fair sort of manner, so we need to take this case to the people of initially New York State and to the people of the United States to say, if our government and our courts won't honor these agreements, it's up to us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we remain hopeful that that can happen and believe that there are many people out there who, when they have the opportunity to learn and hear about these things, recognize that what our nation has done is terribly wrong and that we have a responsibility to be honest and fair and ethical with all of our neighbors.
Mm-hmm, right. And that there, just because the federal government might reject these cases, we know the limits of going to the government for the solution in the first place. Right. And so really working from the grassroots level up for mutual understanding and right ways of living.
Exactly. And, you know, the campaign, through the campaign already, the working relationship and partnership between neighbors of the Onondaga Nation and the Onondaga Nation people and leadership has really deepened in a very powerful way. And as we've traveled to other parts of New York State, other Native peoples have also come forward and been very excited about this opportunity to learn from the Onondaga, to collaborate together.
Mm-hmm.
And you had asked before about participation from other nations in the Confederacy. Right at the new year, the Grand Council met, the Haudenosaunee Grand Council, and issued a very strong statement of support for the campaign, which we were delighted by. And in addition to that, there's been outreach to the other five nations, and there's great interest and support, and quite a number of people from the other nations have applied to participate in this focal point of the campaign, which is a 13-day paddling trek down the Hudson River from Albany to New York City this coming summer, where we're going to seek to bring the treaty to life creating the visual that is pictured on the wampum belt of one row of kayaks and canoes paddled by Haudenosaunee and other Native people, and side by side that a row of non-Native allies paddling side by side in peace and friendship, and stopping along the way for events that would provide an opportunity for Haudenosaunee leaders to share the history and the background, to share the culture, to share social dancing and other efforts to get to know one another. So we think it has great promise for building this movement of people who want to work together for a brighter future.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. It really speaks to the principles of living sovereignty and giving substance to the concepts of peace and friendship, which people throw around so easily as cliches. Mm-hmm. I want to know, too, this is a broad-based educational campaign, as I understand it, it's a statewide one. Could you speak to the history of U.S. treaty making with the Haudenosaunee?
Well, our major treaty that we commemorate every year is the Treaty of Canandaigua. Some call it, we have a belt, some call it the George Washington Belt, which was actually commissioned by George Washington. So that belt, to us, is the words of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And we still... we renew it. We have a celebration in Canandaigua, New York, where our leaders come, and I believe representatives from the government also come and renew that belt. So it's a treaty that is a very important one to us, to all of our people around this area. It promises peace and friendship. It promises the land that our Aboriginal lands that we had at that time that have been dwindled down to small patches.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked for a continuing relationship, but a truth to come out of our treaty relationships. We honor those agreements. I know there's agreements that that the U.S. has that they hold in high regard, like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Well, there are other ones as well, ones made with the first inhabitants of this land that we think should be held in the same regard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from the U.S. perspective, the Constitution does say that international treaties are part of the supreme law of the land, so they very much deserve that honored place that Wendy is calling for. And to step back a little, so that the two-row was made between the Haudenosaunee and Dutch settlers, and the Dutch were soon taken over by the English, who then sort of took over for those treaty obligations and made new treaties with the Haudenosaunee, as did the French. And throughout that process, there was very regular reference to brightening or polishing the covenant chain of friendship, which refers to this series of treaties stretching back to the two-row. And it's very clear that in those early days of the European settlers and then the United States, that those treaties were absolutely necessary for people to be able to survive, for the newcomers to survive here. And Wendy talked about the Haudenosaunee making room for these newcomers. They could have chosen another path, but they are friendly, welcoming people who wanted to share. And unfortunately, they've suffered a great deal because of that desire to share and the lack of sort of response in a like manner from the people who came from Europe and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the dynamics that gets lost on the general public, because when somebody hears, a non-Native person, your average sort of American, hears about broken treaties, often the misconception is that treaties were about the government, the federal government, giving the tribes something, when it was actually the other way around, right? It's the Native nations willing to actually grant land and a place for the settlers, resources, prior to the formation of the United States. And then when the U.S. gets formed, the U.S., is engaged in coercive treaties that compel tribes to give something up, right? A lot of them are treaties of cession where the tribes are compelled to cede something. But it's still about the tribe giving something, whether it's, for the good or the bad, meaning that whether it's in a positive sense or a negative sense, there's an acknowledgement in the treaties that these are tribal lands, that these are sovereign nations.
We actually have maybe fared a little better than our Western brothers and sisters who had many attempts by the U.S. government to change their way of life. They had laws about their religion. They enforced them. They had acts where they would try to, I can't think of the termination policies, actually mm-hmm. instigated against our Western brothers and sisters. We were very fortunate that we did not have those federal policies that interfered with us as they did in some of our neighbors out west. So we're thankful for that. We've always had our leaders looking out for our people, and it continues to right to this day, and we remain an independent sovereign nation, complete with our own government, with our own traditional leaders who are put up according to our way of life that's been handed down for generations, going back, who knows, 1,000 years, maybe 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking to continue, mm-hmm. continue on into the future. No matter what happens, we want to have a good future for everyone. We want to have a place. Our Mother Earth is suffering, and we want to have good water and air for all kinds of life.
Right. Well, also, too, and I want to acknowledge and thank you for pointing out the specificity of the case of the Haudenosaunee and how those treaties are different. And I think that's what's so important and gives life to that concept of sovereignty. And it gives people who are non-native living on Haudenosaunee territory a real specific point of reference. In other words, there are generalizations we can make about the federal government and its treaty brokering, but how everyday people engage the tribal nation on whose land they dwell is another matter. And what I think is so incredible about this campaign is that educational process that really demystifies this, right? It gives people a real concrete, although maybe we need a different metaphor, concrete point of entry or a real specific point of entry to try and relate to the people of the land in a respectful way with integrity.
Certainly, that's very much of our goal, is to share that those understandings, to share the kind of relationship that Noon has built patiently, slowly, over many, many years with the Onondaga. And we recognize that our people have so often broken and violated the agreements that we've made that we always need to be careful and recognize that even after many years, there's times where there's mistrust and that we need to continue to earn that trust by acting ethically and by reaching out to our people to get our the people to change the government policies that cause such suffering and destruction, both to our indigenous brothers and sisters and to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that, those are the really the larger goals of our campaign. And we really encourage folks who are interested to check us out on the web at honorthetouro.org to find ways to support our effort, to consider applying to join us for some of the paddling this summer down the Hudson River, to invite us to come speak at in your communities or colleges and universities. There's a lot of ways folks can get involved. And it's a very exciting time for the campaign. In March, on the 12th, we have a major event in New York City that we're doing in conjunction with Syracuse University and the National Museum of the American Indian to mark the 400th anniversary of the Touro.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following evening, March 13th, there's a program at SUNY New Paltz. And Orrin Lyons, a faith keeper of the Onondaga Nation, will be the featured speaker at both of those events.
Oh, it sounds incredible. And this campaign then runs throughout 2013.
That's right. And, you know, much of the focus is this winter and spring is building for this major, you know, trek down the Hudson River this summer. But the education will continue in the fall. And at that point, we also want to begin to look at how concretely we may shift things, because this, you know, education alone doesn't change the policies that restrict Haudenosaunee sovereignty, the policies that threaten New York with the possibility of hydrofracking, a practice which is already underway
mm-hmm.
in many other states. So in the fall, we'll be looking at where are some focal points where we can really move things to create the kind of change that is needed for all of us.
Mahalo. In Hawaiian, we say mahalo for thanks and admiration. And really appreciate you both being on the call again, Onondaga Clan Mother Wendy Gagne and Andy Major from Neighbors of the Onondaga. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll
thank
be
you.
In touch. You've been listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaolani Kawanui. I want to thank the stations that syndicate this show. And in closing, I want to leave you with a song by Romila Cody. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.
I am my voice, my prayers, she who walks Mother Earth and sings her songs. In all that is sacred, that is said, that is told, I cry for my people, for the world, for it is the world that I carry.